Welcome back to The Deep Dive, your shortcut to being well-informed without the information overload. I'm Chris Vanderbilt, your guide for today's deep dive.
And I'm Alex Astor, here to provide the expert analysis.
Today, we're plunging headfirst into Barron's Magazine for the week of September 1st, 2025. This issue is absolutely packed, a true treasure trove of insights. We're talking the titans reshaping Wall Street, geopolitical energy shifts, evolving market forecasts, and even some, you know, nuanced personal tax strategies.
Yeah.
Our mission, as always, is to distill those truly vital insights, connect the sometimes hidden dots, and give you a crystal clear picture of what truly matters in this complex landscape.
It's a packed issue indeed, and what truly stands out here isn't just the individual stories, but how many seemingly disparate topics are actually deeply interconnected.
Right.
Our goal today is to unravel those threads for you, offering a cohesive understanding of the underlying forces that are truly shaping the markets and the broader economy, and critically, how they impact you.
Absolutely. So let's not waste any time and jump right into our first segment, the cover story. It focuses on a name that has become synonymous with modern finance, Ken Griffin and his burgeoning empire, Citadel. Barron's really paints a picture of Citadel as nothing less than a next-generation Wall Street firm.
That's a perfect way to put it. Griffin's ambition, his strategic vision, and especially his, well, his profound tech savvy are not just propelling Citadel forward, they're fundamentally rewriting the playbook for Wall Street. And what's striking as you dig into the article is the sense that this might just be the beginning of their expansive reach, not, you know, the culmination.
Okay, let's unpack this. The article presents Citadel as this fascinating two-headed business beast, almost like a financial hydra.
Yeah, that's a good analogy.
On one side, you have Citadel LLC, which is their massive $68 billion hedge fund operation, famous for its multi-strategy flagship, Wellington.
Right.
Then on the other, you have Citadel Securities, a sprawling market maker. This dual structure is unique. Can you give us some more details on what makes each of these entities so powerful?
Certainly. Let's start with Citadel LLC, the hedge fund. It truly is a superstar, a titan in the hedge fund world. Their Wellington fund, for example, boasts an almost unbelievable track record. Annual average returns of 19.2% net of fees since its inception in 1990.
Wow, 19.2%.
Yeah. To really put that into perspective for you, that's nearly double the market's performance over the exact same period.
Okay.
Imagine this. An initial $1 million investment back in 1990 would now be worth an astonishing $452
million. $152 million? That's just staggering.
It isn't just beating the market. It's a completely different league. And what's equally remarkable, and a testament to his continued focus, is that Griffin himself still spends the majority of his time immersed in this hedge fund's investment portfolio, despite the enormous growth of Citadel Securities. It shows where his core passion and, you know, intellectual energy still reside.
That's an incredible, almost legendary return profile for the hedge fund. So while Griffin is deeply hands-on with the hedge fund strategy, Citadel Securities seems to be the one making all the headlines with its aggressive expansion and its sheer, well, omnipresence in the markets.
Yeah.
This isn't just a small player in the background. It's truly a colossus.
It absolutely is. Citadel Securities, or CITSEC as it's often known, operates on an immense, almost unfathomable scale. It trades a staggering 25% of all U.S. equities.
A quarter of the market.
Think about that. Nearly a quarter of every single stock trade in the country passes through them. And within that, they handle 35% of all retail flows, meaning a huge chunk of your individual trades are likely routed through CITSEC.
Right.
Beyond stocks, it executes 45 billion options quotes every single day, which is just mind-boggling volume. And it's a top three trader in both U.S. Treasuries and swaps.
45 billion a day.
In total, we're talking about $652 billion in notional trades daily. Their expansion has been relentless. They recently acquired Morgan Stanley's U.S. equity option market maker business, which is a significant move because it effectively leaves no major banks left in this particular market making space.
So they're defining a new prototype, really.
Exactly. This defines a new prototype for the modern financial giant. And what's crucial to understand is that it's not that bulgy, as the article puts it.
Right. I remember that phrase.
They achieve this massive scale with a fraction of the employees and overhead of traditional Wall Street firms. This isn't just efficiency, it's a complete reimagining of the financial infrastructure.
That phrase, not that bulgy, really stands out. It implies a leaner, more technologically driven operation. But beyond just the incredible numbers, what's truly driving this immense success? What's the fundamental why it matters behind Citadel's dominance, and how do they continually stay ahead?
Well, one striking aspect here is Citadel's foundational reliance on math, distribution, and cutting-edge technology to price risk with astonishing precision.
Oh.
They weren't just early adopters. They were pioneers, even coining the term HFT, or high-frequency trading.
They actually coined it.
Apparently so, according to the article. Griffin's strategic foresight is a key differentiator. He consistently positions the firm where the market is heading before the incumbents even arrive.
Hmm.
We saw this with the incremental rise of electronic trading, where Citadel consistently stayed a step ahead of established names like Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley.
Right.
This proactive approach, always looking around the next corner, allows them to carve out dominant and highly profitable positions. They anticipate the evolution of market mechanics and build the infrastructure to thrive in that future environment.
And a very significant part of their market-making business, and often a controversial one, is payment for order flow, or PFOF. Can you explain how that mechanism works and its broader implications for investors? It's often misunderstood.
Yeah, it definitely is. And this raises an important question about market structure and transparency for retail investors, for you.
Mm.
Citadel paid $388 million to brokers like Robinhood and Charles Schwab in just the first quarter of 2025 alone for processing trading orders, particularly for options.
$388 million in one quarter.
In one quarter. Here's how the cycle works. Citadel claims, and has data to support, that they offer superior execution prices, meaning you get a slightly better price when you buy or sell.
Okay.
The superior execution attracts more orders from brokers. The money Citadel pays to these brokers essentially rebates part of the spread. That tiny difference between the buy and sell price, allowing those brokers to offer free trading to their customers.
Which everyone loves.
Which everyone loves, right. This in turn begets more trading volume from retail investors, which directly benefits Citadel's market-making operations. It's a self-reinforcing loop. This mechanism, of course, isn't without its critics, who argue it creates conflicts of interest. It was heavily scrutinized, for instance, during the GameStop imbroglio back in 2021, reminding us that while it enables free trading, it also raises ongoing debates around its fairness and transparency for the individual investor.
So, while you might not pay a commission, the routing of your order is actually a very valuable asset for these market makers.
Precisely.
So it's a virtuous cycle for them, but a contentious one for the broader market. And beyond the PFOF, the sheer data and intellectual capital they possess seems staggering. It sounds like they're operating on a different plane when it comes to information.
It truly underscores their analytical horsepower. Citadel employs an astonishing 260 PhDs, a veritable army of highly specialized experts.
260 PhDs?
Yes, who have access to an astounding 100 petabytes of data. To give you a sense of scale, that's more than the entire print collection of the Library of Congress. This massive data set, combined with their advanced algorithms, is used to identify minute market inefficiencies and arbitrage opportunities, enabling HFT strategies that operate in mere 500 millionths of a second.
500 millionths. I can't even comprehend that speed.
It's half a microsecond. This level of speed, precision, and analytical depth is truly beyond what traditional firms could ever achieve. They're basically seeing patterns and executing trades before others even perceive the opportunity.
It's almost hard to imagine operating at that speed. Now, every success story, even one as meteoric as Citadel's, usually has its moments of challenge. Citadel's hedge fund, for instance, had a near-death experience during the global financial crisis.
Yes, and this is a crucial part of understanding their resilience. The hedge fund lost a staggering $9 billion, plummeting 55% during the global financial crisis, bringing it to death's door, as the article vividly describes.
Wow, 55%.
They also had notable failed attempts to expand into areas like investment banking. However, their ultimate recovery and subsequent explosive growth demonstrate not only incredible resilience, but also a profound capacity to adapt, learn from setbacks, and then strategically refocus their efforts on what they do best.
Right.
They faced existential threats and emerged stronger. A powerful lesson in market survival.
That's a powerful testament to their adaptability and tenacity. Shifting gears a bit, Ken Griffin, the individual, is almost as fascinating as the firm itself. His personal wealth and influence have truly ballooned over the last decade.
Oh, absolutely. What really stands out here is the sheer scale of Griffin's personal accumulation. His net worth has soared from $6.1 billion a decade ago to an incredible $48.3 billion today, making him the world's 31st richest person.
$48 billion.
This immense wealth isn't just from his hedge fund payouts. He also holds significant stakes, an 85% ownership in Citadel LLC, and an 80% stake in Citadel Securities.
So he owns most of both companies.
Pretty much. Beyond his firm, his personal portfolio is equally vast and eclectic. Over $1 billion in prime real estate, spanning New York City, the Hamptons, London, Hawaii, and Palm Beach.
Quite the property empire.
He possesses a nearly $1 billion art collection featuring masterpieces by Picasso, Van Gogh, and Warhol. He also collects priceless historical documents, including a rare copy of the U.S. Constitution and the Emancipation Proclamation, and perhaps most uniquely, a $45 million Stegosaurus.
A $45 million Stegosaurus. Okay, that certainly puts a unique stamp on a collection.
Doesn't it?
He's also a major philanthropist, so he's not just accumulating.
That's right. His philanthropy, channeled through Griffin Catalyst, now exceeds $2 billion. This includes significant contributions to vaccine development, notably supporting Operation Warp Speed during the pandemic, and a remarkable $2.255 million donation to Mr. Beast's water philanthropy efforts.
Interesting connection there.
The article notes an interesting detail here, suggesting it seems very important to Cam that the world knows how wealthy he is, which offers an intriguing insight into his public persona, perhaps distinguishing him from other high net worth individuals who prefer to keep their wealth more private.
He's certainly not shying away from his position, and his political influence is equally substantial as a major Republican donor.
That's correct. He's a prominent Republican donor, and while he's publicly offered both praise and criticism for Donald Trump, he notably issued a strong warning against attacking the independence of the Federal Reserve. This highlights his deep understanding of macroeconomic stability and his conviction that the Fed's autonomy is crucial for the health of both the American and global economies, suggesting his priorities extend beyond mere political alignment to fundamental financial principles.
It speaks volumes about his priorities. Let's talk about the culture at Citadel. What kind of environment does Griffin cultivate to attract and retain the kind of talent that can operate at such a demanding pace?
Well, the Citadel culture is often described as one for great athletes, a place where only the best of the best thrive.
Right.
The firm's intense hiring process is legendary, with an astonishingly low 0.4% acceptance rate for summer interns.
0.4%.
Yeah. Employees note that it requires operating in a different gear compared to traditional firms like Goldman Sachs, with demands of 150%. Former executives have described it as akin to playing for Real Madrid. You simply don't keep your spot if you're not consistently producing at the highest level.
Wow.
It's an exceptionally demanding high-performance environment, with one close to Citadel joking, Ken's not yelling at you, he's yelling with you. It paints a picture of intense collaboration and shared pursuit of excellence, albeit one that requires extraordinary commitment.
That's quite a demanding analogy. Now, one aspect that has always raised questions is this separate but shared structure, where Griffin owns both the hedge fund and the market maker. How do they manage potential conflicts of interest, especially with such close proximity and shared infrastructure?
Yeah, this raises an important question about market integrity and information flow. The article emphasizes that executives stress there is zero communication and absolutely no trading information transfer between Citadel Securities and Citadel LLC.
Okay, they're very clear on that.
Very clear. This separation is maintained despite them sharing office buildings, some back office functions, and even a common logo. The intention is to prevent the hedge fund from gaining an unfair advantage for the market maker's proprietary order flow data.
Right.
However, the article explicitly states that Citadel Securities itself does use trading information derived from its market making business for its own separate strategies.
Okay, that's a key distinction.
It is a crucial distinction. The market maker uses its data for its own benefit, but it's not supposed to flow to the hedge fund. This intricate structure is part of their unique model, aiming to leverage market-making insights while segmenting information to prevent direct conflicts between the two entities in a way that would be detrimental to clients.
And what about the future trajectory? With such a dominant position and innovative spirit, what's next for Citadel? Where does Griffin envision taking this empire?
Well, the future trajectory for Citadel is described as basically limitless. Alfred Lin of Sequoia, the venture capital firm, points to boundless possibilities in investment, trading, market making, advanced analytics, and leveraging their technology for clients. They are also aggressively focused on geographic expansion, particularly into bonds and European operations, and significantly ramping up their client-facing efforts. Citadel Securities CEO Peng Zhao explicitly states their ambitious goal is building the capital markets firm of this generation.
Wow.
Griffin himself articulates an even grander vision, discussing where these businesses will go over the next century. It's not just about current market dominance. It's a vision of sustained, aggressive growth, innovation, and an enduring market presence, fueled by a relentless drive to redefine financial services.
So when you think about the very integrity of the markets, or how your own trades are executed on a daily basis, Citadel's influence is undeniably profound. For you, understanding this behemoth helps demystify the complex, high-speed forces shaping modern finance. It's not just about a company, it's about the very architecture of how money moves and how prices are determined in today's world.
Absolutely.
From the intricate high-speed world of Wall Street, let's transition to international economics and Mexico's energy situation, which is facing its own set of unique, deeply rooted challenges. Specifically, we're talking about the nation's state-owned oil company, Petróleos Mexicanos, better known as Pemex.
Yes, and one striking aspect here is the stark contrast between Mexico's rich potential petroleum resources and the grim reality of Pemex's financial performance.
Right.
Typically, national oil companies are cash cows, reliable revenue streams for their governments. But Pemex lost a staggering $30 billion last year and is currently saddled with over $100 billion in debt despite repeated substantial cash injections from the Mexican Treasury.
$100 billion in debt. Losing $30 billion. That's just unsustainable.
It really is. And to make matters worse, production has been slashed by half over the last 20 years, now hovering at about 1.6 million barrels a day. Mm. This isn't just underperforming. It's a drain on national resources, a significant missed opportunity.
That's a truly dire financial situation for a company sitting on such immense potential. Mexico's new president, Claudia Sheinbaum, has unveiled a recovery plan. What does that entail, and is it seen as a viable path forward?
Well, Sheinbaum's stated goal is ambitious, to get Pemex off state dole by 2027 and add 200,000 barrels of output by 2030.
Okay.
However, the analyst community is largely skeptical. Duncan Wood of the Inter-American Dialogue notes that much of the initial optimism for her energy policy, which many hoped would be more pragmatic, has sadly faded away. Mm. The concern is that the proposed plan, while well-intentioned, simply isn't robust enough to reverse decades of decline and underinvestment.
Why the skepticism? What's the core issue preventing Pemex from truly capitalizing on Mexico's vast oil and gas reserves, despite the clear need for revenue?
The core issue, and what's particularly challenging here, is Sheinbaum's deep adherence to the nationalist energy philosophy of her predecessor, Andrés Manuel López Obrador.
AMLO, right.
Exactly. López Obrador famously slammed shut the door to private collaboration, a door that Enrique Peña Nieto had opened in 2013-14, yielding genuinely promising results with major international oil companies.
Right, I remember that opening.
Carlos Ramirez Fuentes, a partner at Integrilla, recounts how all the major oil companies had committed billions at that time, eager to invest. Sheinbaum's proposed mixed public-private contracts are widely seen by analysts like Fuentes as absolutely entirely insufficient to attract major private oil giants.
So not enough incentive.
Exactly. As he puts it, it's simply not the way this is done anywhere in the world. If you want serious investment and expertise in deep water or complex fields, the ideology of national control is overriding the pragmatism needed for economic viability.
So, a clear clash between nationalist ideology and pragmatic economic needs. Beyond the contracts themselves, are there other overarching concerns for potential international investors looking at Mexico's energy sector?
Yes, this raises an important question about the broader investment climate and the rule of law. López Obrador's controversial judicial reform, which Sheinbaum defends, further complicates the investment landscape.
Uh-huh. The elected judges plan.
Exactly. This reform, which will see all of Mexico's judges elected by 2027, challenges the very foundation of the rule of law from an investor's perspective. Nuria Orba from Vontobel Asset Management highlights that investors, especially those with very long time horizons and significant capital at risk, will be careful before engaging in this institutionally complex environment.
Understandable.
This constitutional shift creates profound apprehension for those considering multi-decade capital-intensive investments, as it introduces political risk into the judicial system itself.
It sounds like a difficult environment to attract the necessary capital and expertise, which are both crucial for deep water exploration and complex energy projects. There was also some financial engineering recently to buy Pemex sometime, right? Essentially a temporary band-aid?
Yes, the government did implement what many consider a short-term fix. In late July, the finance ministry issued $12 billion in pre-capitalized securities through an off-balance sheet vehicle, effectively funneling much-needed cash into Pemex.
Okay.
This move initially provided some relief, leading to a two-notch upgrade from Fitch Ratings and a 10% jump in Pemex's 2047 bond prices.
Hmm.
While this provided much cheaper financing for the company, as Zorba observed, Fuentes warns that this Band-Aid won't last.
Right.
Without a clear and credible path to increase production, which absolutely necessitates cooperation with big oil, the underlying financial problems will persist. The government is essentially telling Pemex, we will help you with your debts until 2027, then you're on your own.
Mm.
But Fuentes believes, quite starkly, that it's not going to happen unless there's a fundamental shift in strategy.
It appears there's a disconnect between these short-term financial maneuvers and the long-term strategic needs. Interestingly, President Sheinbaum has garnered high praise globally for her diplomatic skills, especially with U.S. President Donald Trump, and she enjoys a high domestic approval rating. Yet, she seems reluctant to use that considerable political capital to shift López Obrador's entrenched energy legacy.
This truly begs the question, why not leverage that considerable political capital for a more pragmatic energy policy? Her deft diplomacy with President Trump has given her a strong 75% approval rating at home and high global marks, signaling significant political strength.
Right.
Yet she seems unwilling to expend that on what many see as critical energy sector reforms, reforms that could fundamentally transform Mexico's economic future. This reluctance to deviate from her predecessor's nationalist stance on Pemex is viewed as a significant missed opportunity, perpetuating a self-imposed economic handicap for Mexico.
Mm. The political will to change seems to be lacking where it's arguably most needed.
It seems so.
For you, this isn't just a regional story about Mexico. Mexico's inability to fully tap its vast oil reserves impacts global supply and, by extension, global pricing. It also serves as a critical case study on how deeply political ideology can shape a nation's economic potential, affecting everything from energy security on a global scale to the viability of international investment decisions. It highlights the often complex interplay between politics and economics.
Well said.
Moving from the intricacies of energy politics, let's shift our focus to the broader stock market outlook, which Barron's describes as potentially colorful this fall, calling for bargain buys and more diversified gains beyond what we've seen recently.
Yeah, and what's truly illuminating here is the S&P 500's underlying resilience. It's up a solid 10% year-to-date, and that's despite a significant 19% tumble between mid-February and early April due to tariff fears that sent shivers through the market.
Right, that was a scary few weeks.
It was. The key insight, however, is the visible waning of the Magnificent Seven trade. After driving major indexes for 2 years, their concentrated popularity started to fade. The new focus, as Barron's highlights, is broadening to interest rate-sensitive sectors like financials and industrials, to beaten-down value stocks and healthcare, and crucially, to small caps.
Mm-hmm.
These sectors are generally cheaper, offering more attractive valuations, and are poised to benefit significantly from expected Fed rate cuts and ongoing fiscal stimulus. It's a rotation, a broadening of opportunity.
So we're seeing a shift from concentrated leadership where just a few mega caps carried the market to a potentially broader rally. But let's be honest, the market isn't exactly cheap, with the S&P 500 stretched at 24 times estimated earnings, well above its 10-year average of 20x.
Yeah.
How do valuations and earnings look across the broader market beyond just those top seven names?
Well, this raises an important question about where the value truly lies.
Mm-hmm.
While the Magnificent Seven earnings are expected to grow a robust 24% this year, they come with supersized valuations exceeding 30 times forecast earnings, leaving, as the article puts it, less room for error.
Very little room.
Any misstep at those multiples could be severely punished. However, the outlook is significantly more optimistic for the rest of the market and for small caps, with double-digit profit growth expected in 2026 for these under-owned segments.
Okay.
Jim Caron of Morgan Stanley Investment Management describes this confluence of factors as a bullish cocktail, a recessionary-type response from the government in the form of substantial fiscal stimulus, like the tax cuts embedded in the One Big Beautiful Bill, arriving precisely at a time when the economy's just slipped, combined with likely Fed rate cuts.
Interesting phrasing. Bullish cocktail.
Yeah, this combination creates a particularly fertile ground for a broader market rally that moves beyond just tech giants.
That's a compelling picture suggesting opportunities beyond the obvious. Can you walk us through some of the specific sector-specific opportunities that Barron's highlights, especially for investors looking for value?
Certainly. Let's break it down by sector. In financials and industrials, Barron's points to small-cap regional banks like UMB Financial and Home Bank shares, which are noted as attractive values, trading at under 13x earnings.
Okay, under 13x.
These are often more sensitive to interest rate changes and could benefit significantly from rate cuts. Industrial stocks such as Herc Holdings, Clean Harbors, and Knight-Swift also look attractive as they are tied to broader economic activity.
Mm-hmm.
Healthcare is another sector with compelling values, particularly as the iShares U.S. Healthcare ETF has been relatively flat year-to-date and trades at a modest P.E. of 16.5.
16.5, much lower.
Much lower. Specific value plays cited include Thermo Fisher Scientific at 22x earnings and Becton Dickinson, which is trading at under 14x earnings.
And what about consumer stocks, which often tell a story about the average American's spending power or opportunities beyond the U.S. market entirely?
For consumer stocks, the regional grocery store owner Weis Markets is highlighted as an interesting play, trading at 18x trailing earnings and 27 by 2025 non-GAAP earnings.
Okay.
Also mentioned is the grocery delivery service Instacart, which at 23x earnings is seen as unfairly punished due to what some perceive as exaggerated competition fears.
Interesting.
Looking beyond our borders, non-U.S. stocks offer another intriguing alternative. The iShares MSCI EAFE ETF, which tracks developed markets outside the U.S. and Canada, is actually outperforming U.S. stocks with a 21.5% year-to-date gain, yet trades at a significantly lower 16 by 2025 earnings.
Wow, outperforming and cheaper.
Exactly. Examples include Samsung Electronics at 16x earnings, the Italian cable maker Prysmian at 20x forward PE, and the Japanese wiring company Fujikura at 28x earnings, both offering indirect exposure to the AI data center build-out at what are considered reasonable valuations. This suggests global diversification is well worth considering.
It seems like there's a lot of value outside the usual suspects, especially if the broader market rally gains traction. What's the outlook for the bond market amidst the shifting equity landscape? Is it still a place for stability, or are there opportunities for return there as well?
Well, the bond market, as expected, has been considerably less volatile than stocks, with the iShares Core U.S. Aggregate Bond ETF up a modest 2.5% year-to-date.
Okay.
The 10-year U.S. Treasury yield has largely been range-bound, fluctuating between 4.2% and 4.7%. Mona Mahajan of Edward Jones sees particular value in the 7 to 10-year part of the market, offering potential for price appreciation if the Fed does indeed cut rates.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Laschini of Janney suggests intermediate treasuries, around 3 to 7 years, are fair valued, especially if inflation pressures persist and rate cuts are less aggressive than some hope.
Right.
For those looking at corporate bonds, Eli Lilly 5-year bonds and shorter-term bonds from Scotts Miracle-Gro and H.B. Fuller are cited as attractive for their combination of yield and credit quality. So even in bonds, there are strategic plays to be made.
That brings us to an interesting observation from Torsten Sluck, Apollo Global's chief economist, who suggests that what some might call boring stocks are actually outperforming big tech over the long run. This really challenges the narrative we often hear.
Yeah, it really does. This raises an important question about investor focus and the pursuit of hype versus consistent performance. Sluck points out that humdrum names like Tractor Supply, a retailer you might not think of as a market leader, have actually outperformed Apple since 2001, more than doubling in the last 5 years compared to Apple's 83%.
Wow, Tractor Supply beating Apple.
Right. Similarly, Domino's Pizza has outperformed Alphabet since 2007, and Old Dominion Freight Line, a trucking company, gained 56% versus Amazon's 33% over the last 5 years.
Hmm.
The powerful takeaway here is that these companies, while less flashy, offer better and more stable returns with fewer sleepless nights, despite generating significantly less hype.
Fewer sleepless nights sounds good.
It does. It fundamentally challenges the narrative that only high-growth tech can deliver superior long-term results, encouraging you to look beyond the headlines.
That's a great perspective. Emphasizing stability alongside returns, a balance often overlooked. Now, as August ends on a down note, many investors are starting to prepare for the September swoon, which is historically the worst month for stocks. Is this just historical superstition, or is there a real cause for concern?
Well, indeed, the downbeat end of August suggests an early start to September's historical weakness. Investors are really holding their breath for a potential Fed rate cut on September 17th, driven by recent economic pessimism. The August jobs report is expected to show only 92,500 jobs added, a clear signal of sluggish growth.
Pretty weak number.
Very weak. However, there are still lingering concerns about persistent inflation, with producer and consumer inflation data due on September 10 and 11, respectively, which could easily throw a wrench in those rate cut hopes.
Right.
And of course, the ongoing impact of tariffs continues to be a wild card. Kayla Cedar of State Street Global Markets warns that excitement about the future of rate cuts could actually be a risk, as cuts are far from guaranteed and the Fed remains strictly data dependent.
Good point.
So while history suggests caution, the current market is navigating a complex data environment.
But there's also a new tailwind for earnings, thanks to the One Big Beautiful Bill, which could mitigate some of that September anxiety.
That's absolutely right, and it's a critical counterpoint to the short-term worries. Wall Street analysts are expecting this significant fiscal stimulus bill to drive impressive earnings growth, 11% in 2025, and an even stronger 13% in 2026.
11 and 13%, that's significant.
It is. This, combined with the fact that the rest of the market is reasonably valued compared to the Magnificent Seven, with the Invesco S&P 500 Equal Weight ETF, which gives every company in the S&P 500 the same weight, trading at a significant discount creates what some see as a bargain hunting opportunity if a September slump does occur.
Okay.
So while short-term caution is warranted, the underlying economic tailwinds and more attractive valuations outside of big tech suggest that any dip could be an opportunity, not a cause for outright panic.
This brings us to a fascinating, almost philosophical discussion about why the market keeps ignoring Jack Bogle's iron rule of reversion to the mean. This bull market is described by some as a Rasputin. It just can't be killed off, despite stubbornly high interest rates, a bewildering series of tariffs, slowing job growth, and housing market weakness. It seems to defy all historical gravity.
Yeah, this truly begs an important question. Why is the S&P 500 up a robust 10.2% year to date, following astounding gains of over 23% in both 2023 and 2024?
Right. It just keeps going.
All this while its price-to-book ratio is exceeding 1999.com crash levels, and its trailing PE is nearly 30. It certainly seems to defy Bogle's iron rule that prices eventually revert to their historical mean. It's almost as if something fundamental has changed, breaking the old patterns.
The article explores a couple theories on this death of reversion to the mean. One comes from Adam Cecil of Gravity Capital Management. What's his argument?
Well, Cecil argues that we're experiencing a profound structural change in the economy. He questions whether traditional brick-and-mortar retailers like Kohl's and Target will ever come back to their historical mean valuations, or if giants like Amazon will revert significantly on the downside. He points out a dramatic shift. Tech's market value share has jumped from 19% in 2004 to a staggering 46% in 2024, with companies like Microsoft and Amazon consistently growing much, much faster than the overall economy.
46%, almost half the market.
Almost half. His theory is that the world has fundamentally reconfigured itself, driven by technological advancement and disruption, rendering the old mean reversion less applicable in certain sectors that have either been permanently transformed or those that are leading the charge. The old averages simply don't apply when the landscape itself has been reshaped.
And then there's a more radical and frankly quite alarming theory from Michael Green of Simplify Asset Management, who squarely blames the rise of passive investing.
Yeah. Green, who is often called the Cassandra of passive investing, presents a compelling, if unsettling, argument. He contends that passive investing, which now accounts for a massive $17.59 trillion or 53.4% of all mutual funds and ETFs, is actually causing mean expansion.
Mean expansion. Okay, explain that.
Here's his logic. Passive investors consistently pour money into market cap weighted indices, which by definition means more and more capital gets funneled into the largest companies, disproportionately inflating the valuations of the Magnificent Seven.
Right, because they get bigger, they get more money.
Exactly. He believes this shrinking effective float, meaning the actual number of shares freely trading that aren't tied up in passive funds in these heavily weighted stocks, reduces price elasticity and dramatically amplifies price movements, both up and potentially down. Green has modeled this and unfortunately suggests it could lead to a horrific crash when the dynamics inevitably shift. Bogle himself in 2017 presciently noted that if everybody indexed, the only word you could use is chaos, catastrophe. So while this Rasputin bull market continues to defy gravity, the underlying dynamics, according to Green, are creating a dangerous and potentially unstable imbalance, one that could revert to the mean in a very brutal way.
For you, these insights aren't just about hot tips, but about understanding the powerful undercurrents shaping your portfolio. Are you too concentrated in big tech, potentially falling victim to mean expansion? Or are you strategically poised to capitalize on a broadening rally? And critically, are you prepared for what historical patterns or these new market dynamics might bring next to your investment strategy? It's about asking the hard questions of your own portfolio.
Definitely critical questions to ask.
Let's turn our attention now to the intersection of politics and the economy, starting with a rather controversial and unconventional idea emerging from the Trump administration. The Accidental Sovereign Wealth Fund. It's certainly a departure from traditional U.S. economic policy.
It really is.
Yeah.
This truly raises an important question about the evolving role of government in the economy. President Trump's administration is almost inadvertently creating something akin to a sovereign wealth fund by systematically taking equity stakes in private companies.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, these include a 9.9% stake in Intel and a 15% stake in the rare earth magnet firm MP Materials.
Right.
And there are future plans outlined in the article, potentially demanding equity from other chip makers who receive two IFTEs Act grants, and even defense firms like Lockheed Martin.
Mm.
Furthermore, in a fascinating twist related to trade negotiations, the U.S. is also set to receive 15% of NVIDIA and AMD chip sales, specifically in China. This is a very different kind of industrial policy than we've seen before.
This is quite a departure from traditional U.S. policy, which generally favors private sector-led growth and avoids government ownership in companies. Why is this considered a bad idea by many economic experts?
Well, Velu Kofotak, a finance professor, provides some compelling reasons. His research, spanning over 100 nations and more than $10 trillion managed by sovereign funds globally, indicates that most sovereign funds are generally indifferent investors and, frankly, poor at driving innovation, primarily due to political interference.
Okay. Political interference is key.
Very key. He cites examples like Saudi Arabia's often goofy real estate projects, such as The Line, as illustrations of politically driven, economically questionable investments.
Right.
Unlike many SWF-rich nations, the U.S. already grapples with significant trade and budget deficits, and crucially, already boasts a highly skilled and robust venture capital industry perfectly capable of funding innovation.
Good point.
Finance professor Bill Meganson raises additional concerns about transparency and the potential for politicization of these stakes, worrying about the problematic precedent this sets for future administrations, regardless of their political stripe. It introduces a new layer of government intervention that many see as inefficient and susceptible to cronyism.
So, a lack of transparency, the risk of political meddling, and potential inefficiency are key concerns. But are there any examples of successful sovereign wealth funds globally that the U.S. could perhaps emulate, even hypothetically?
Well, what's truly fascinating here is that there are rare exceptions that demonstrate success. Norway's oil fund, for instance, nearly $2 trillion in size, is celebrated for being transparent, professionally managed, and crucially insulated from day-to-day political interference.
Okay, Norway's the gold standard.
Pretty much. Singapore's Temasek is another standout, having compounded its portfolio at an impressive 14% annually, with the government notably having no board presence, allowing it to operate purely on merit.
Right.
Meganson suggests the U.S. should ideally emulate these models if it were to pursue such a strategy. But he notes the significant challenges, primarily funding such a fund with high U.S. national debt and the need to diversify beyond purely strategic sectors like chips and defense to achieve broad-based returns.
Mm-hmm.
Moreover, studies by Fotech consistently show that government-funded innovation often results in patents that are worth far less than those developed by the private sector, suggesting a fundamental disadvantage in the government's ability to pick winners.
So while the model for successful sovereign funds exists, the U.S. context, with its unique debt profile and political environment, makes it difficult to replicate successfully. What then is the Trump administration's rationale for pursuing these equity stakes? And how does Steven Marin, Trump's pick for Fed governor, defend them?
Well, Steven Marin, currently the chair of the Council of Economic Advisers, argues that these stakes are primarily about protecting taxpayers when the government provides substantial support to companies.
Okay, taxpayer protection.
He clarifies that the money for these grants was already out the door from the previous administration's CHIPS Act.
Mm.
And this isn't about the government actively picking winners, but rather improving overall U.S. competitiveness through general policies. Marin outlines their broader industrial policy as tariffs, deregulation, full expensing, and energy abundance, arguing that these are justified by national security concerns in a world increasingly characterized by geopolitical adversaries.
Mm-hmm.
he explicitly states his preference for market incentives, citing Operation Warp Speed during the pandemic as a successful example, over direct government intervention and picking individual winners and losers.
That's a comprehensive view of their industrial policy using a broad set of tools. Let's delve into some of Marin's other economic policy views, starting with his rather controversial stance on tariffs and inflation. Many economists would argue that tariffs are inherently inflationary.
Yes, and what's particularly striking here is Marin's strong assertion that there's no evidence that tariffs have been inflationary thus far.
Really? No evidence?
That's his claim. He puts forth a counterintuitive argument, suggesting that imported goods are actually getting cheaper relative to domestic ones, which is the opposite of what one might expect.
Mm-hmm.
He posits that foreign exporters ultimately eat the tariff, meaning they absorb the cost rather than passing it fully onto U.S. consumers, effectively making it a one-time tax change that prices adjust to, and then the economy moves on.
Okay.
He also sharply criticizes companies, accusing them of conveniently blaming tariffs for their problems, while simultaneously failing to credit positive policy changes, such as the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, deregulation, and energy abundance for their profits.
So turning the tables on corporations.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
He implies that companies are quick to find scapegoats, but slow to acknowledge policy benefits.
He certainly doesn't pull his punches in his analysis. What about his outlook on the labor market and immigration, two highly contentious areas of economic policy?
Well, Marin offers an optimistic labor outlook, describing the current situation as a pretty good place, with no sign of material layoffs, and anticipating marked improvement ahead. On immigration, his view is quite firm. He argues that stricter border policy is great for the economy. He contends that imported workers drive down wages for Americans and drive up prices for Americans, particularly for housing.
Right.
He sees a tighter border as ultimately disinflationary, as it shifts the supply-demand dynamics in housing and, in his view, allows young, less skilled Americans to get their foot on the ladder in the labor market by reducing competition for those entry-level jobs. It's a very specific economic argument for border control.
And finally, he has some pointed criticisms regarding government data reliability, which is crucial for policymakers.
Yes. Marin levels significant criticism at the Bureau of Labor Statistics for what he perceives as declining data reliability. He specifically notes larger and larger revisions to initial monthly estimates, sometimes quite substantial.
Mm.
He views this as effectively rigged, blaming the previous commissioner for not taking proactive steps to improve data quality, which he sees as fundamentally reducing the data's utility and reliability for both policymakers and the public over time.
So there's a significant amount of policy and political intervention being discussed, challenging many conventional economic assumptions. But let's connect this to long-term economic forces. Mark Chandler argues we're heading for another great moderation of slow, steady growth rather than a period of high volatility.
Yeah, this truly raises an important question about the persistence of structural forces versus cyclical fluctuations. Chandler argues the economy is inexorably drifting back towards a period of slow, steady growth, low inflation, and low interest rates, reminiscent of the mid-1980s to 2007.
Okay, for Great Moderation Part 2.
Exactly. He points to two main powerful structural forces driving this. First, surplus capital.
Mm-hmm.
A global savings glut stemming from persistent trade surpluses in many nations, abundant corporate cash, and the growth of sovereign wealth funds. This immense pool of capital, he argues, pushes down real interest rates worldwide.
Right.
He cites negative or near zero real policy rates in places like Switzerland, Japan, and the ECB. And research from the New York Fed anticipating sustained near zero secured overnight funding rates. This oversupply of capital relative to investment opportunities acts as a powerful anchor on rates.
And what's the second major foundational force he identifies?
The second is demographics.
Right.
A global dearth of births and shrinking labor force growth rates are fundamentally constraining potential economic output and, in turn, keeping natural interest rates low.
Mm. Fewer workers, lower growth potential.
Precisely. This also suggests a persistent struggle for aggregate demand, as fewer people entering the workforce means less overall consumption and investment capacity over the long term. These two forces, surplus savings and sinking demographics, act as long-term anchors, powerful currents pulling the global economy in a particular direction.
Right.
While geopolitical shocks like the Ukraine war or climate disruptions will still occur, Chandler argues they are ultimately transitory, economies will inevitably drift back to the structural norm once disruptions are absorbed. The increasing dominance of less cyclical service industries further contributes to a longer, flatter, and less volatile business cycle.
So a world of persistent low inflation, low growth, and low interest rates, despite the temporary shocks that grab headlines.
Exactly. Candler concludes that while policymakers may resist labeling this as another great moderation, the underlying conditions are undeniable and powerful. He emphasizes that productivity growth will be absolutely key for any nation to thrive in this environment, and businesses and investors will face an ongoing struggle to find genuinely profitable outlets for investment.
Mm-hmm.
In such a world, per capita GDP, rather than just headline GDP, becomes the crucial metric for success and quality of life, a lesson Japan has demonstrated over decades. It suggests a future where these deeper structural patterns will continue to anchor advanced economies, often overriding the noise and fragmentation of short-term events.
For you, these are the truly big-picture forces government policy on trade, immigration, and investment, combined with these profound global demographic and capital trends that will fundamentally shape the economic environment for decades to come. It's about discerning the long-term signal from the short-term noise in how decisions are made and how they ultimately impact your personal economic outlook and planning.
Couldn't agree more. Understanding those long-term currents is vital.
Now let's shift to some more specific, actionable investment strategies, starting with small-cap stocks. Barron's is making a bold suggestion that small-cap stocks are rallying again. This time, it's real. What makes them so confident?
Well, what really stands out here is the Russell 2000's strong August, which saw a 7.5% jump, significantly outpacing both the Dow and the S&P 500.
Okay, strong performance.
Yeah, and this rally was notably accelerated by Fed Chair Powell's dovish Jackson Hole speech, which ignited optimism for small caps to outperform. The reasons are compelling and interconnected. Likely Fed rate cuts are expected to support the U.S. economy, which is a huge benefit for domestically focused small caps.
Right.
These cuts also crucially reduce interest expenses for smaller companies, many of whom carry floating rate debt. And of course, the ongoing fiscal stimulus from Washington, like the One Big Beautiful Bill, provides an additional tailwind. It's not just a fleeting bounce. There are fundamental drivers this time.
So more than just a head fake rally this time, there are real economic undercurrents supporting them. And it sounds like there's still significant upside potential in terms of market capitalization, suggesting they're historically undervalued compared to their larger counterparts.
Exactly right. Chris Shipley from Fort Washington Investment Advisors highlights a key metric. The combined market capitalization of Russell 2000 companies is currently a little below 5% of the overall Russell 3000 index's value.
Only 5%.
Only 5%. Historically, small caps typically make up a much larger share, ranging from 7% to 10% of the broader investing universe.
Right.
This significant disparity suggests substantial room for upside, implying that small caps are still undervalued relative to their historical weighting and their potential contribution to the overall market. It's a strong argument for reallocation.
So if you're an investor looking to capitalize on this, where should you be looking within the small cap universe? Are there any specific picks or sectors that Barron's highlights as particularly attractive?
Yeah, Barron's highlights several intriguing picks across diverse sectors. For unique niches in consumer-oriented companies, they suggest Stride, which focuses on K-12 online learning, Murphy USA, the gas station operator, and Madison Square Garden Entertainment.
Okay.
Other discount retailers like Ollie's Bargain Outlet, plant-based milk maker Sonopta, and pawn shop operator First Cash are also mentioned as attractive, often recession-resistant plays.
Interesting mix.
In smaller software stocks, banking software firm Q2 and hospitality software company Agilysys are identified as oversold, presenting potential value after recent pullbacks.
Got it.
What's also compelling are the strong fundamentals underpinning this optimism. Russell 2000 earnings are expected to jump 10% this year and a remarkable 30% in 2026, after falling in both 2023 and 2024.
30% growth in 26.
Yeah, a big jump. And finally, increased M&A activity, like Gildan buying HanesBrands for $4.4 billion, is buoying multiples across the sector, creating what the article calls a perfect storm for small caps.
A perfect storm for small caps sounds promising for those looking for growth. Now, let's look at some insider actions that might signal confidence, specifically with Boeing, a company that's faced its fair share of challenges recently.
Yeah, and what's Particularly noteworthy here is the news that Mortimer Buckley, the highly respected former Vanguard CEO and now a current Boeing director, made his first stock purchase as a director, buying 2,200 shares for nearly $500,000 on August 19th.
$500,000, his first purchase. That's significant.
It is a significant insider confidence signal, especially given the context. It occurred amidst ongoing labor contract negotiations and a machinists' union strike.
Right.
However, it followed a substantial 103 plane order from Korean Air, which had already boosted the stock. Boeing shares are up 33% this year, so this insider action suggests a deep-seated belief in continued upside and a positive long-term outlook for the company, despite its well-publicized operational challenges.
That's a strong vote of confidence from a very astute investor. And what about AT&T? There was a large acquisition from EchoStar recently, but it seems to have dispelled fears about its dividend, which is often a key draw for investors in these types of companies.
Yeah, this raises an important question for income investors who rely on stable dividends. AT&T's $23 billion spectrum acquisition from EchoStar was substantial, but the analysis suggests it's not seen as a threat to its attractive dividend.
Okay, good news for dividend investors.
Definitely. Strategically, this acquisition significantly strengthens AT&T's 5G and fiber leadership. Crucially, it prevents a potential fourth competitor from acquiring that spectrum, which benefits AT&T, Verizon, and T-Mobile by maintaining a more favorable competitive landscape.
Ah, keeps the competition down.
Exactly. Financially, AT&T maintained its guidance of $2.02 per share in earnings for 2025 and reaffirmed its $20 billion share repurchase plan through 2027, all while demonstrating solid dividend coverage, with roughly half of its free cash flow returned to shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
Citi analyst Michael Rollins sees a compelling 14% total return for AT&T, combining a 10% price appreciation with its robust 3.9% dividend yield. Verizon also looks attractive with a potential 15% total return, so the sector as a whole appears to be presenting opportunities for both growth and income.
Shifting to the competitive tech landscape, Salesforce stock has had what Barron's calls a terrible 2025, but the article suggests it might now be too cheap to pass up. What's driving its woes, and why is it considered a bargain?
Well, indeed, Salesforce is down over 25% this year, facing an undeniable threat from AI, and widespread concerns that escalating AI spending is crowding out other software spending.
Right. The AI spending concern is big.
It is. However, the article argues quite compellingly that it might now be significantly undervalued. It's currently trading at 22 times earnings estimates, which represents a 10-year low, dramatically below its 54x average.
Wow, that's a big drop from its average.
Huge drop. Its PEG ratio, price earnings to growth, of 1.4 is also notably lower than competitors like Oracle, 2.4, and Microsoft, 3.9, suggesting the market is overly pessimistic about its growth prospects.
Hmm.
Potential catalysts for a rebound include Salesforce's own aggressive AI initiatives with Agentforce, strategic acquisitions like Informatica, and the increasing influence of activist investor Starboard Value, which has boosted its stake and historically spurred growth and efficiency improvements in companies.
Oh, the activist angle.
Exactly. Okay. Analysts, despite the recent stock performance, are overwhelmingly positive on its long-term outlook.
So, a potential rebound play there for a well-established tech name. What about the undisputed AI giant NVIDIA? Despite some noise around China, it's still poised for a blockbuster year, and the stock remains cheap, according to Barron's. How can a stock that surged so much still be considered cheap?
It's a great question, and what's truly fascinating here is how NVIDIA continues to defy expectations.
Mm.
Its second quarter revenue was up a staggering 56% year over year, and its third quarter outlook beat expectations, even with no H20 sales from China and none assumed in guidance due to geopolitical issues.
So the China situation is just potential upside then?
Exactly. The article says China revenue for NVIDIA is all upside from here if those geopolitical tensions ever resolve, adding a potential bonus.
Okay.
The main driver, however, is the full production wrap-up of NVIDIA's new NVL72 and GB300 NVL72 rack servers.
Okay.
These massive systems contain 72 link GPUs costing millions each and are absolutely crucial for advanced AI training. The surging networking revenue, up 46% quarter over quarter, provides strong evidence of this ramp up. Despite the stock doubling from its April lows, some analysts still consider it almost cheap at 32 times forward earnings. especially when considering its forecast 50% earnings growth.
32 times for 50% growth. Okay, I see the argument.
Yeah, the argument is that for a company at the absolute epicenter of the AI revolution, with such explosive growth, a long-term view reveals significant value even at these elevated levels.
And finally, a notable insider sale from Palantir CEO Alex Karp. Does this signal a lack of confidence, or is there more to the story?
Well, yes, Alex Karp sold over $60 million in stock, but the context is crucial.
Mm-hmm.
It was primarily to cover tax withholding obligations after restricted stock vested. He still retains a massive stake of over $1 billion.
Ah, okay, so tax-related, not necessarily bearish.
Likely. Palantir stock, despite having doubled year-to-date, recently saw its longest losing streak since April 2024, amid lofty valuation concerns and broader AI market skepticism.
Yeah.
This skepticism was amplified by comments from OpenAI CEO Sam Altman about investors being overexcited about the technology sector as a whole. So while a significant sale, it's often a routine event tied to tax rather than a complete divestment, but it does reflect a period of market reevaluation for AI plays, where investors are scrutinizing valuations more closely.
For you, these sections offer genuinely actionable insights, from diversifying into small caps for growth potential, to understanding the nuances of insider signals as indicators of confidence, to evaluating dividend plays for income and stability, and of course, navigating the volatile but promising tech sector with a critical eye. It's about seeking value and growth in unexpected places and staying informed about leadership changes and strategic decisions that impact companies directly.
Absolutely. Lots of concrete ideas there.
Finally, let's conclude our deep dive by exploring some truly cutting-edge investment strategies, starting with what Barron's calls hedge funds' new secret weapon, the rapidly evolving world of alternative data.
Yeah, and what truly underpins this segment and what's fascinating here is the sheer breadth and depth of alternative data. It's essentially the collection of non-traditional information, anything from granular truck movements and high-resolution satellite imagery to anonymized credit card transactions and even sophisticated social media sentiment analysis, all designed to gain an informational edge beyond standard financial reports.
Okay.
For example, the company Genlogs uses nearly 1,000 cameras to track semi-trailer trucks, offering real-time insights into economic health and the specific performance of companies like Walmart or J.B. Hunt, sometimes weeks before official earnings releases.
Wow, tracking trucks with cameras. It's like having a secret window into the economy.
Exactly.
That's a very tangible example illustrating just how granular this data can get. How big is this market, and how is the rapid advancement of AI influencing its explosive growth?
Well, this market is experiencing absolutely explosive growth. It was a $3.3 billion market in 2025, projected to reach $8.6 billion by 2030, with some even more aggressive estimates pushing it as high as $39.9 billion.
Huge growth potential.
Huge. The adoption is widespread, with two-thirds of institutional investors now using alternative data, double the share from just 2 years ago.
Mm.
AI is undeniably a massive tailwind here.
Right.
Advances in computer vision and natural language processing enable the analysis of entirely new data types, such as raw camera footage or unstructured PDF documents, and significantly improve the quality and interpretability of existing data. This also makes it accessible to a broader range of investors, including what the article calls the long tail of smaller funds who previously lacked the resources to leverage such sophisticated tools.
So AI is democratizing access to this informational advantage.
To some extent, yes.
So it's clearly becoming an arms race for superior, timely information. But with such intimate data collection, what are the ethical considerations here, especially regarding individual privacy? That's a significant concern for many.
It really is. And this raises an important, almost philosophical question about the line between market intelligence and individual privacy, a line that is constantly being challenged. Elite funds are undeniably in an investment arms race to secure novel data sets, recognizing that clean, high-frequency data is absolutely crucial for their quantitative models to maintain an edge.
Mm-hmm.
Where information was once scarce, it's now incredibly abundant, fundamentally shifting the edge from merely obtaining data to expertly interpreting it.
Right. The interpretation is key now.
Exactly. However, privacy is a major concern. Vendors vehemently stress anonymization, with companies like Genlogs instantly deleting images of private vehicles to protect individuals. But the insatiable appetite for data, even on executives like tracking private jet movements to infer corporate activity, pushes ethical boundaries.
Hmm.
As Crisil analyst David Easthope notes, there's a voracious appetite for this data. And where the line is, I frankly don't know. I think that line will get pushed. It's a Wild West situation. where technology is advancing faster than regulation or ethical consensus.
That's a critical point to consider as technology continues to advance and data collection becomes even more pervasive. Now, let's transition to an entirely different asset class where active management, surprisingly, is proving its worth. Commodities. We're seeing a new breed of active commodity funds beating indexers, which goes against the common wisdom in equity markets.
Yeah, what's genuinely fascinating here is this countertrend. While the investment world for stocks has largely moved towards passive index funds, commodity funds are actually shifting towards active management, and for very good reason.
Why is that?
This is largely due to inherent structural flaws in traditional passive commodity indexes. These flaws include exclusions of important commodities, like cocoa, for example, causing indexes to completely miss major rallies in those specific markets.
Uh-huh.
Then there's the issue of futures contract rolling and front-running, where indexes typically buy short-term futures contracts and then predictably roll them over to the next month as they near expiry. Savvy traders can easily front-run these predictable moves, forcing indexes to pay more and eroding returns.
Right, because everyone knows when they have to roll.
Exactly. And finally, the inability of passive indexes to exploit backwardation, which is a market condition where the current price of a commodity is higher than the price for future delivery. This is a gift for active managers because as the futures contract gets closer to expiry, its price tends to rise to meet the higher spot price, generating extra roll yield.
Okay, so they profit from that convergence.
Precisely. Passive indexes often get caught in contango, where future prices are higher, which is a drag on returns. Good active managers strategically avoid contango and exploit backwardation.
So active managers clearly have clear strategic advantages in the commodity space due to these structural quirks. Can you give us some concrete examples of these active strategies in action and how they translate into better returns?
Certainly. Let's look at some successful active strategies. Managers like Greg Chernow of the PIMCO Commodity Strategy Active ETF achieve significantly better roll yield, about 3.5 to 4 percentage points better than traditional indexes, simply by strategically selecting which futures contracts to invest in, avoiding the costly rolls.
4 points is huge.
It's massive in commodities. Then there's the AQR Risk Balanced Commodity Strategy Fund, which stands out by weighting commodities based on their volatility. This ensures each commodity contributes equally to the overall portfolio risk, a stark contrast to production-value-weighted indexes, like the S&P GSCI, which could be 60% energy.
So better diversification.
Much better risk balancing. This intelligent weighting led to a remarkable 19.0% five-year annualized return. Additionally, the parametric commodity strategy benefits from being more broadly diversified across commodities and frequently rebalancing to emphasize cheaper, undervalued commodities, directly addressing the concentration issues inherent in passive indexes.
It sounds like there's a very strong data-backed case for a more nuanced, active approach in commodities. Are there any quasi-active indexes trying to bridge this gap, taking some of these lessons and applying them in a more systematic way?
Yes, that's a growing trend, and it's really interesting. Some indexes are specifically designed to address these flaws, essentially blurring the line between passive and active management.
Okay.
For example, the index tracked by the USCF Summerhaven Dynamic Commodity Strategy ETF is designed to be smarter. It equal weights the 14 commodities exhibiting the most backwardation again, capitalizing on that roll yield opportunity.
Got it.
This strategic design has delivered exceptional returns, boasting a 22.1% five-year return. It highlights that the more an index tinkers with strategy to optimize it and account for market realities, the less it resembles a purely passive investment, and the more it benefits from active insights embedded in its design.
So it's a testament to the power of smart design in areas where simple market cap weighting just doesn't work. For you, this showcases how the pursuit of alpha, that extra return above the market, is constantly evolving, from harnessing massive alternative data streams to dissecting the complex nuances of commodity futures. The modern investor's toolkit is expanding dramatically. It challenges us to think beyond conventional wisdom, even in traditionally passive areas, and ask, where is the true information advantage now? What does it mean for how you approach market intelligence, and how will you adapt your own strategies to capitalize on these new frontiers?
Really forces you to rethink passive assumptions.
We've covered a tremendous amount of ground today, pulling truly vital insights directly from Barron's Magazine for the week of September 1st, 2025. We've unpacked everything from the tectonic shifts in Wall Street with Ken Griffin's Citadel Empire and the fundamental changes it brings to Mexico's energy quandary and its deep connection to political ideology. We looked at the stock market's post-Magnificent Seven landscape and the contentious economic policies shaping our future, including the controversial idea of a U.S. sovereign wealth fund. We've even looked at the secret weapons of hedge funds with alternative data and the smart, active plays in commodities.
As we've seen, the financial world is constantly reinventing itself, often with a fascinating blend of innovation, disruptive technology, and profound political influence. This raises an important question for you to ponder. In an era where information is abundant but often contradictory, and market dynamics are increasingly complex and challenging old rules, how will you adapt your own framework for understanding value and risk, not just for today, but for the decades to come?
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time, stay curious, stay informed, and keep digging deeper into the forces shaping your financial world.